prose writer's medium, or as those of us who do write poetry refer to them as those bastards who get paid to write. So they'll be coming up soon. And thank you, Sarah, Damien, Jody, and Jane for joining us tonight. We really appreciate that. So there's beer here, did you know? It's worth knowing. All right. This is fun. Frank O'Hara wrote this. Memorial Day, 1950. Picasso made me tough and quick in the world. Just as in a minute, plane trees are knocked down outside my window by a crew of creators. Once he got his axe going, everyone was upset enough to fight for the last ditch and heap of rubbish. Through all that surgery, I thought I had a lot to say and named several last things Gertrude Stein hadn't had time for. But then the war was over. Those things have survived. And even when you're scared, art is no dictionary. Max Ernst told us that. How many trees and frying pans I loved and lost. Guernica hollered, look out. But we were all busy hoping our eyes were talking to Paul Klee. My mother and father asked me, and I told them from my tight blue pants, we should love only the stones, the sea, and heroic figures. Wasted child, I'll club you on the shins. I wasn't surprised when the older people entered my cheap hotel room and broke my guitar and the can of blue paint. At that time, all of us began to think with our bare hands. And even with blood all over them, we knew vertical from horizontal. We never smeared anything except to find out how it lived. Fathers of Dada, you carried shiny erector sets in your rough, bony pockets. You were generous, and they were lovely as chewing gum or flowers. Thank you. And those of us who thought poetry was crap were throttled by Auden or Rimbaud. When, sent by some compulsive Juno, we tried to play with collages or Sprechstunde in their bed. Poetry didn't tell me not to play with toys, but alone I could never have figured out that dolls meant death. Our responsibilities did not begin in dreams, though they began in bed. Love is, first of all, a lesson in utility. I hear the sewage singing underneath my bright white toilet seat and know that somewhere, sometime, it will reach the sea. Gulls and swordfishes will find it richer than a river. And airplanes are perfect mobiles. Independent of the breeze, crashing in flames, they show us how to be prodigal. Oh, Boris Pasternak, it may be silly to call on you, so tall in the Urals, but your voice cleans our world, clearer to us than the hospital. You sound above the factory's ambitious garble. Poetry is as useful as a machine. Look at my room. Guitar strings hold up pictures. I don't need a piano to sing, and naming things is only the intention to make things. A locomotive is more melodious than a cello. I dress in oilcloth and read music by Guillaume Apollinaire's Clay Candelabra. Now my father is dead and has found out you must look things in the belly, not in the eye. If only he had listened to the men who made us, hollering like stuck pigs. So the only reason that poem still exists by O'Hara is because John Ashbery copied it out and put it in a letter to the poet Kenneth Koch. And Kenneth Koch kept the letter. When Frank O'Hara died, that poem was from 1950. He died in 66. his friends got into his apartment first so they could save the palms. That was their main mission after Frank died. We gotta save the palms. He didn't publish very much in his lifetime. Two small collections and a couple smaller collections. And when they got in there and they started pulling stuff out, they had reams and reams of poetry. And even that wasn't all of it, because that poem was not a part of it. Ashbery had to save it. It's in that letter. My love for O'Hara is not a split. If you've ever heard me read my own poems, you know he's copying O'Hara. What I love about Frank O'Hara is that ephemerality was something he was okay with. He wrote the poems because he needed to, and because he loved the people around him, who usually those poems were either a memorial to, or dedicated to, or a catalog of their lives and circumstances. Poetry at that time was shifting, and more things in the world were coming into it. Pepsi, Mad Men type stuff, advertising, records, and all that stuff, which wasn't considered to have the weight of what poetry had been. Poetry was about memorials, about testimonials, about orders, about important things. But Frank just kept writing these poems day after day. There's a great film of him, which you can watch on YouTube. A public station did a series about poets in the mid-60s. And you can watch him writing a poem or writing, what's he doing? He's writing a play with his co-writer while talking on the phone, while talking to the person who is filming him for this film. And it's all going down all at once. And that's just kind of how he worked. What I love about him is that he understood that the moment was what should be memorialized. And he served in the military. He understood what Memorial Day was all about. But in his poem, what it becomes is the moment of creation. And that poem's about creating and about being a creator. And that what we create out of our lives and the lives of our loved ones. And our creations are reflections of that. And that while the history of poetry might say those things are not the appropriate subject of a poem, O'Hara's poetry always says, what, are you stupid? Of course it is. You're human. You're alive. That is the subject of poetry. And that is what we celebrate every other week, right here with you. And we appreciate you coming out. So thank you again. And now this prose thing is going to happen. And I hear it might take off with the kids these days, but I don't know. Jury's out. We'll see. Here comes Joe.
This working okay? Okay, great. Great to see so many of you here tonight. And hi to all of you in Zoom world. Yay! Our first reader tonight of prose is Damian Drasik, author of the novel 40, Hatchtown, and the Flash collection, Fables of the Deconstruction. His writing has appeared in numerous literary journals and anthologies, including New Orleans Review, Cutback, Smoke Long Quarterly, and more. He is the winner of the Harriet Arrow Award and the Jesse Stewart Prize. He co-hosts WANA Live, a largely virtual reading series that brings some of the best Appalachian writers in the world to that audience. He also serves as editor-in-chief for the journal Appalachian Lit. Please welcome Damian Dressy.
Thanks everybody for coming out tonight. I really appreciate it. It's always good to see people interested in walking so they commit literature when it's this nice outside. I want to thank you for reading Frank O'Hara. I'm not intimidated. I think maybe next group you could maybe go with James Comey's new novel. Just to,
set the bar a little. Just
right. Thanks everybody. It's a piece called Cleanliness. I come home to the smell of meat. Not the subtle wafting of sirloin tips or pounded cutlets sauteing as a prelude to being served with thick sticks of asparagus, but the concentrated odor of raw meat, pungent, overpowering, as if our front door led to the killing room of an abattoir. Briefcase still in hand, overcoat across my shoulders like a cape. I follow the broken trail of styrofoam packaging and plastic wrap through our cramped shotgun apartment to the bathroom. Chops and shanks, roasts and ribs oxidize in a brown heap next to the space heater. My boyfriend, a firefighter who's recovering from a bad time, punches in our cramped tub, drizzling the remains of one of the packages through his thinning hair. And I ask, what has happened? He smiles beatifically up from the tub. I spent $170 at the butcher shop. He is nude. His pubic hair is soaked flat against his body. A pool of thin red fluid has formed beneath him and rises to the top of his pale feet. Although wildly inappropriate, this spectacle reminds me of the time my sister Carol had a period in the pool. I am being washed in the blood of the lamb, he tells me finally. My boyfriend is relaxed. Unconcerned with my reaction, he keeps on wringing what I believe to be a shoulder chop across his hairless chest a little below the nipples. That's a metaphor, I tell him. That means if you go to church, God will forgive your sins. Are you so sure of that? And although in 15 minutes, I will call the psychiatrist and Lewis will spend several days under observation before returning home with a prescription for a powerful antipsychotic. For this one luminous moment, the way he looks up at me from his pool of watery redness, the relief etched across his face as with numinous acid, this man I love, he makes me wonder. I think most people like to eat, so this is called the food speaker. In Italy, long ago, nestled far up in the mountains where the thin air chilled and the pure sun shone, there was a village that for generations had dispersed with language in favor of food as the agreed upon method of communication. Crisp pastries plumped with seek no more apples smoothed the way in courtship. Demitasses of steaming espresso suggested the need to be vigilant. Tureens of cold parsnip soup seasoned with bitter herbs alerted a man to his wife's budding anger. Neither Bibles nor portraits, but recipes were passed down through families. What better way, the villagers thought, to tell a girl her great-grandmother had been hot-tempered and adventurous, then sending her a stew so spiced with cayenne and paprika, it singed the tongue just to taste it, or to let children know that Uncle Gio came from Naples, then placing before them heaps of fusilli doused with a red sauce stewed from dozens of the season's finest heirloom tomatoes and bursting with fresh basil. Every year at Midwinter's Eve, when the days were short and friendships brittle, the village pulled itself together for a tremendous feast. Ham cured with honey and platters of trout and heaps of succulent greens graced a table the length of a horse farm. And all the villagers sat down together to break bread and mend fences. The meaning of this meal for the villagers was, we are a good people of hardy stock, living close to the earth. Our hearts know the bitter and the sweet, and like meat cured in the smokehouse, we will last. Year after year, the festival meal became more and more elaborate. It started with men chanting the high, snowy passes to trek to the railway station in Abruzzi to bring back fresh lamb. Then, boys borrowed bicycles and later cars to retrieve seasonal fruit from the sun coast in Spain. As this augmentation increased, the meaning of the festival evolved to signify, we are a prosperous village, industrious, and willing to exert every effort to get our due. By the time the fresh shrimp and oysters were being trucked in from the islands far to the south, the festival had come to mean as the best and most eloquent village in all of Italy. La Elementare degli Altoparlanti, or the food speakers, we are entitled to know every dish on the green earth and every delicacy plucked from the deep blue sea. Nearly all of the people in the village were proud of its growing fluency, and myriad flutes of champagne were hoisted high in celebration. The first year, the lobsters packed in ice were flown in by helicopter. An old man rose to castigate his fellow villagers for forsaking their time-honored ways. His fork trembling, he fed everyone seated around the long table a small bite of each of the old dishes in turn, and flung each of the arrivist foods to the snowy ground. As he did this, all the villagers raised their bitter cups, lock in step, and placed them carefully back in their saucers without having drunk to show penitence. But as the meal ended, they brought the old man a small plate of almonds, sprinkled with a fine dusting of poison. In the old language of food, this meant, shut the hell up, you old fossil, you've talked enough. With no protest, the old man lodged himself quietly in a chair at the end of the long festival table, and sitting alone, ate the almonds, chewing meticulously, happy, at least for this last short day, to have put things right.
You know, I used to be a technology executive, so this is really embarrassing on some level, but I didn't know how to, I messed up with the stopwatch. It's not actually running, it says like 2 seconds, I think I tapped the button twice. So I have really no idea how we're doing on time, but all we want. It's called boyhood. When I was a young boy, growing up in a steel town, preoccupied with collapsing in on itself, I wanted to shoot my father with a .22 caliber rifle. He had given me the single shot bolt action rifle for my 10th birthday. And for many nights afterward, I fantasized about striding into his bedroom in the middle of the night and pushing the barrel flush against his chest as he slept and pulling the trigger. In these imaginings, I would always give some impassioned, self-justifying speech right before squeezing the trigger and seeing the muzzle flash and hearing the crack of the rimfire cartridge propelled down the blue barrel. My father, a former infantryman in the Marine Corps, would have to listen to these speeches because he would be too scared to move. In my pre-assassination screeds, I would trumpet my secret strength, extol my individuality, and rant about how I wasn't going to take any more of his beatings. Some mornings after nights like this, I would ride my father's secondhand car down to the unemployment office. My father and his buddies, most of whom were also laid off from the town steel mills or the bituminous mines, referred to these trips as going to town. Once, in the afternoon, as a boy growing up in a steel town, pretty far gone irrevocably to shit, I attempted to stab an uncle of mine to death with an 8-inch fish filleting knife. My uncle was a large, bushy, bearded man laid off of his job as a rail car welder. I walked in on him beating my grandmother with a leather belt. She had fallen to her knees in the eat-in kitchen of her frame house. She held her other hand above her head, elbow bent at an acute angle to ward off the blows. My uncle's voice filled the room like whiskey and ice cubes can fill a glass. My grandmother's breath was all gasps. Tears streamed from her eyes. She pleaded, "Stop, Eddie. Oh, please stop." Oblivious to anything but his own rage, my uncle raised the belt and brought it down again. I watched this happen once, then twice. The third time he brought the belt above his head, I picked up the fillet knife from a cutting board next to a brook trout on the sideboard near the door. I ran toward my uncle, cursing him, fillet knife held out in front of me like a sword. My uncle turned. With the back of his hand, he sent me sprawling. When my father came in from parking the car, he saw the condition my grandmother was in, put my uncle in a wrestling hold, later called the volunteer ambulance service. What I'm trying to say is this. Even though the biggest part of me feels like these things happened in another lifetime, happened almost to someone else, that's never going to be the important part. Day or night, I can be inside out with the need to twist this darkness into some trompe-l'oeil kind of virtue, into something I can wear. Like grace.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Wow, thank you, Dean. Jody Tanner is an award-winning journalist and longtime book lover. She is one of the founders of the Pittsburgh Institute for Nonprofit Journalism and covers books and literary life in Pittsburgh with a specific focus on writers and books in and around Pittsburgh, the Rust Belt, and Northern Appalachia. Please welcome Jody Tanner.
I am one of the founders of Pinge, and I'm really happy to be here tonight because it means I don't have to be at the Golden Quills Journalism Media Award. So, yeah, Brittany Hiller is there for me instead. We formed Pinge about 2 years ago, and we're really excited to have survived this long. I've been covering books and literature here in Pittsburgh for a long time and really tried to focus on local writers, but expand that understanding to include Northern Appalachia and parts of the Rust Belt. I am currently at work on a book about literature in Appalachia for West Virginia University Press. That's what I'm going to read to you from tonight. I've become curious about how writers in the region, you know, cracks and reflect and interpret the region for readers here. And the book is also part memoir. All right. All right. So the book is also part memoir, which is to say, I put myself in the story in a way that I don't when I'm doing the journalism. So it is partly about growing up in a small mill town in Western Pennsylvania and my evolving understanding of this place, of Pittsburgh as part of Appalachia and how I fit in it. I've been on the road a lot, traveling the region. So I'm going to read from a chapter that is about the pressure to leave Appalachia, the pressure to leave hard places. It's about my own experience with that, but it's also about how artists are interpreting that for us. Quote, "The beauty forcing us as much as harshness." Jack Gilbert, Searching for Pittsburgh. There was a time in my young adult life when it felt like I lost a friend every week. Not that they died necessarily, although some did. I moved into the city at the end of the 1980s and began the process of coming out. It was the height of the AIDS crisis, and for a gay person in Pittsburgh, or anywhere, death was never far. Keith Haring died, then Freddie Mercury, and lots of people you never heard of died too. Just as much, there was a steady decline as people simply moved away. The exodus wasn't biblical, and the constant drip of leaving wasn't a daily or even weekly occurrence. But a diaspora did happen. The steel industry doomed. Everything just folded in on itself. Although the flight has now taken on mythic proportions in its retelling, and lots of us did stay, I do recall with sharp clarity times when I hesitated to cultivate new friendships. Such was the relentlessness to the drain. You should move to Charlotte, to Phoenix, to Houston, to DC, to Seattle. That's what people said. Move someplace without rotting steel mills and abandoned train yards and old slag heaps. Move someplace that wasn't a union town struggling to hang on in Reagan's America. Move someplace without the long gray Pittsburgh winters pressing down. Move somewhere where the old man bars and the union halls were raised or never were to begin with. Move to where things weren't painted with the residue and dregs of hard, dirty industry such that we could never get clean. Fill in the blank with that flavor of the month boomtown, that's where you should be. A place with shiny new developments and shopping areas and ever available office cubicle jobs. Those places made me feel shabby. Like I should watch the NASDAQ index breathlessly, or be trendier, or at the very least, want to shop more. In the mid-1990s, I'd lay in bed in my apartment in one of the city's more than 90 distinct neighborhoods and wonder if a place this big could disappear. I thought of abandoned skyscrapers and Three River Stadium crumbling and full of cobwebs. I pictured shuttered up homes along the rivers and creeks and through all the hollows of the city. I thought of kudzu covering the WPXI television tower. Maybe a Carnegie Library would remain standing, an oddity for tourists in a city of scant humans. I imagined Pittsburgh as the old gold rush place the family visited in a favorite episode of the Brady Bunch. In They Will Put My Body Into the Ground, poet Jack Gilbert wrote, "Even Pittsburgh will vanish, leaving a greed as tough as winter." I didn't know Gilbert's work back then, though he was a Pittsburgh guy, specifically an East Liberty Peabody High School guy. To be fair, I didn't know many poets then, but as a former literature major, I knew the Mobile canon. I had studied Wordsworth and Coleridge, Shelley, Byron, and Keats. I read Milton's Paradise Lost and Shakespeare's sonnets. I learned how to parse poetry, how to read Old English, and I think I even understood iambic pentameter, although it always seemed fake to me. These poems were intellectual puzzles to master, an academic's Rubik's Cube, or a math question in verbal form. None of them landed lower in my body than my forehead. Later in life, on my own, I found Lucille Clifton, and poetry opened up in a new way, warming my body from my lower abdomen to my chest. While researching this book, I attended several readings by the great Kentucky writer Crystal Wilkinson. She said once that poetry lived in her gut, and I felt that too. Of course, she's creating poetry and I'm just taking it in, but it does seem to live in that place, inside your core. And I feel like if poetry lives where Crystal Wilkinson says it does, then I'm doing something right. I wonder now what it might have meant to have read James Baldwin's poetry when we were all living in the eye of the HIV storm, or to know poetry that spoke to workers. How might I have understood myself, my town, my place, had somebody pointed me to poets who wrote in the modern vernacular of industry and cities and labor and capitalism? It was many more years before I discovered the verse of Jack Gilbert, who worked briefly as a steelworker. And though most of his career was spent in Europe and then San Francisco, Pittsburgh's DNA is all over his work like a messy crime scene. For me, Gilbert lights up the castaway forgotten places and people. He might have helped me understand why I stayed and saw beauty in such harsh, unappreciated places. Ashley Blooms grew up in an unappreciated place too. She grew up coal poor in a small place in Kentucky. In her brilliant 2022 novel, Where I Can't Follow, she combines a deep sense of home with a touch of magic to explore complicated feelings around loving a hard place and choosing to stay. Her protagonist, Maren Walker, lives with her grandmother in the fictional town of Black Dam, Kentucky, named such for the deadly asphyxiant mine gas. Blooms told me about the first time she heard of Black Dam from her miner father. They were going to be mining close to a much older mine that had been long since abandoned, and that was one of their concerns. They were not wanting to cut into an old shaft because it could contain black dam, she said. But she also remembered just loving the sound of it, black dam. It sounded like being inside a coal cocoon. Blooms' town of Black Dam is not a real place, though it is wholly real life Eastern Kentucky, a place ravaged by extractive industry and the opioid epidemic. It is also a place of extraordinary beauty, so ruthless and dramatic, it's hard to take in all at once. Blooms' writing, born from and of her home place, rings true in all its contradictions. When we meet Mary, she's trying to care for her granny as the elder woman slides slowly toward dementia. She works at a convenience store, skips lunch almost daily to try to save even a tiny bit of money, and struggles to pay off a small, but for her, insurmountable debt. She has lived with her indomitable and sometimes difficult granny since she was little, since her mom left. Now, as a young adult, Mary feels she owes it to her granny to take care of her so the woman can breathe her last in her very own home. It's also hard, and living on the knife's edge of poverty, Maren feels it all slipping away. And here, Blooms pulls a rabbit out of a hat. Not everyone, but many people in Black Dam get a little door, an interdimensional portal, not wholly understood, but accepted by the population of the novel. It's an escape hatch or a paranormal exit. It's not clear where one goes after going through the door. Do they vanish into the ether? Does it lead to death? An alternate reality, a different dimension? Do they go to the upside down? Nobody knows. But the mystery of the gateway is accepted. Mary's door appears in a field behind the modest house she shares with Granny. It's not really a door. It doesn't look like the door to your house or your bedroom closet or a Walmart. It's earthier and more organic, like a ball of dirt and moss and sticks and clay. But Mary knows it's her door. She could just leave. She could leave behind feeling overwhelmed and intense economic pressure. She could just walk through the door and let go of that rope she's clinging to with everything she has. There is a point at which Maren, beyond desperate, pulls up in her bedroom, reading her mother's old journals. I didn't want to make choices. I didn't want to explain myself. I just wanted to read, Maren writes. And every one of us, every kid who found joy in words on a page, who wanted or needed to escape through books, can relate to Maren in that moment, even if we've never set foot in Eastern Kentucky. But Maren stays, and not just out of obligation. She stays because she loves the place. She loves her friends. She stays because the mountains feel right and it feels like home. And when she thinks of leaving, she thinks of going only as far as Lexington, only a couple hours away. Blooms told me that sometimes she writes out of spite more than anything else, which seems as good a reason to me as any. Telling stories that feel more authentic to my experience and adding them to that conversation so that it doesn't feel so much like there are important things that are getting left out or overlooked, Bloom said, that means a lot to me. Writing about that struggle of trying to stay in a place that doesn't feel like it's always made for you, but it is also made for you, and you feel like you were made for it. That struggle of trying to make a home in a place that isn't really hospitable all the time. My wife is a therapist. She thinks about things differently than I do. She tells me this thing about how our brains contain a map of our lives, a map of the people we're close to in the center, and it works its way out. I think of it like a heat map, showing the inner circle of one's own life and lightening in color or intensity as it works its way away. She tells me about research on how grief disorders our brain map. When someone dies, the map remains and our brain has to hold conflicting information. That person's location in the brain map, and that person is dead and gone. When that person is an anchor in your heat map, when they're at or near the center, it can throw everything off keel. Years after my mother's death, my brain is still holding conflicting information. I wonder if that's just true with moms. I wonder too, if this applies to physical space and topography. Separate from the trauma and loss of 9/11, I think how disoriented New Yorkers must have felt for the longest time, seeing a skyline without the Twin Towers. At home, when I drive across the Homestead Grays Bridge connecting Squirrel Hill to Homestead, I think of Carnegie's Colossus steel operation that is now an ill-conceived sprawling shopping area. The smokestacks remain to remind us of what used to be there and how you can't replace that with the chain brewery and movie theater. I also wonder this when I drive through Western Pennsylvania and Eastern Kentucky and West Virginia, when I pass deserted coal tipples and abandoned beehive ovens. I spent some time in Hazard, Kentucky, and talked to a couple of fierce women there who fight for clean water and fight against mountaintop removal. I wonder how long it will take for their brains to adjust to the missing mountaintops.
Wow, thank you, Jody. Looking forward to this book. Jane McCafferty writes and publishes across genres. She is the author of 4 books of fiction. Her work has been awarded 2 Pushcart Prizes and NEA, the Drew Hines and others. Recent stories have appeared in Catapult, Iowa Review, Crazy Horse, and The Sun. She lives and works in Pittsburgh, teaching at CMU and for the Mad Women in the Attic. She is working on a 3rd short story collection. Please welcome Jane McCafferty. Thank you so much. Thank you everyone for being here and for the first two readings. Wow, great to be here. This is a short story. It's called Now That She's Gone Forever. My mom was great, but she didn't know how to let go. I mean, we were best friends since day one, but she wasn't one to act her age. Someone said act your age is the most American expression ever. I don't mean to be the most American ever. I just mean my ma, she never acted her age or wanted to, and instead just acted my age. She couldn't help it. She admired and adored me, so she wanted to be like me and be my age and not hers. Maybe she didn't act my age when I was a baby. I mean, she didn't wear diapers and crawl around with me on the floor and cry for a bottle, as far as I know. And if she did, I'm grateful she never told me, and glad we were too poor for home movies and lots of photos back then, because who would ever want to see such a thing? We worked in downtown Wilmington at a candy store, making people happy from 9 to 2:30 p.m., and then got a job in a liquor store, and then in a diner on Kirkland Highway, and then for a carpet company, and she was a seamstress who mended things for several people through the years. Thank God my father sent us money for rent each month. He was a nice guy, but 15 years older than my mom, and he'd always wanted to go to Alaska. So he did, just after I was born. By the time I was 2, we were wearing all the same outfits, which she sewed herself late at night on the Singer sewing machine under a lamp in the front room, which was kind of a drafty porch with plastic over the windows. So she wore the blue coat with the black velveteen collar, which was just like my blue coat, only longer. She also got Gail Tryon, the neighbor lady, to sew. We're twins, she liked to say. We'd stand in front of the mirrors and make the same facial expressions to prove it. When I was 7, we marched in the mother-daughter parade in Atlantic City in happy dresses covered with nice red and green apple print, and people took our picture. One day, Gail Tryon told me we were heading for a crash. That's a terrible thing to tell a child. In my case, it made me the most anxious of children, since of course I thought she meant car crash. And every time she drove off to work, I panicked. When I was in the car with her, biting my nails, looking out at other cars like they were all enemies, my mom would say, "I wish children could drink whiskey sours, because you really need to calm down." But Gail Tryon was wrong. We weren't headed for a crash. We were headed for great times at county fairs, hikes in sun-dappled woods, and best of all, weekends in New Jersey, on boardwalks and beaches. We wore these big terry cloth things, yellow with a single rose on the square breast pocket, over our matching blue suits. The thing is, even at the time, we knew we were lucky. We'd take a moment to thank God and our lucky stars at least once a day. And we had so many colorful matching dresses then, and I can still see them hanging. There were the peacock dresses, the lighthouse dresses, the zebra dresses, the Irish fair dresses, and we had red and white striped matching summer pajamas. We had basically the same plaid jackets in the fall and even the same sneakers, red Keds with white laces. In the pictures my great aunt once took when we visited Ohio, we stand in front of giant corn stalks, hand in hand, smiling twins, one small, one huge. And it wasn't just our clothing that was similar, it was our activities. We liked the same things. We had years when we were up at the park on swings making up songs together. Every day, even in the snow, we'd sit side by side on the swings and start swinging and singing. This was in the years before I went to school and then the years when I was in elementary. She would sometimes pick me up at school since I had to get allergy shots, and I told her things about my classmates and she never forgot anything I said. For instance, one day I told her, "Janine Twist's father is pretending to be allergic to lobster, and her mom's from Boston and thinks you should have lobster on Thanksgiving. And I heard Janine tell her friends that they fought so loud she thinks it's going to be Splitsville for Mr. and Mrs. Twist." This was fourth grade. I had never heard the term Splitsville, and I enjoyed using it, which was the only reason I'd told the story. And all these years later, I would never have remembered this lobster fight story if my mom hadn't asked about the twists several times after this. "How are the parents of Janine Twist?" she'd say out of the blue, as if they'd become important figures in her imagination. And I'd say, "I'll have to ask Janine," but then I wouldn't ask because she was one of the most popular girls. And the only time I asked her something, a simple, "Can I borrow your eraser?" she'd said, "Nobody who's not in the top 10 borrows my eraser." I hadn't even known there was a top 10. In ninth grade, I began turning a little evil. An evil teen busting out the way God must have intended, or maybe just following nature's directions. I have to forgive myself, because did I ask for that nature? No, that nature was thrust upon me and all of us, at least in America, or at least it was back in the 20th century. But I wasn't the worst evil teen, not like my friend and neighbor Tracy Harvey, who stole her mom's car and vanished into the night, leaving a note saying, "Don't waste your time trying to find me." She never came back, and Mrs. Harvey cried to my mom saying, "What did I do wrong? Why would Tracy do this to me, Maggie?" And my mom was not unkind, so she didn't say, "Well, Eleanor, you shouldn't have made Tracy go on a diet and clean the house and cook dinner and join fencing for fanatics with those rich kids." Instead, my mom said, "Look, you tried your best. It's all us mothers can do." And Mrs. Harvey said, "Well, that's easy for you to say. You and your daughter wear matching outfits, holding hands on Front Street." "Not holding hands anymore," my mom said. And now she's dressing in Salvation Army clothing. And I think she's smoking marijuana. It's over, Eleanor. And it was over. Splitsville. I broke her heart. I had to. Every child has to do it, whether God or nature gave us the job, I don't know. "Don't feel bad, kid," she told me one night. "It happens, and it was great while it lasted." But I was backing away from her even when she said things like this, because her eyes were sad. I started hiding in my room. I dressed in large shirts a man named Stanley had once worn to work in gas stations. I was called Stanley by a few friends at school. I packed up all the clothes she'd made me over the years, didn't take them to Goodwill, but hid them in the back of my closet, because suddenly I was caring about what other people thought, how they saw me, how they saw her. I cared more about their opinions than I did her. like I said, evil. Around me, my ma acted like nothing was wrong and made her usual macaroni and cheese or stew or tomato soup after work. Life went on and we imitated normal people. She dressed like a mom, I dressed like a kid. Sometimes we watched television, Jeopardy, Golden Girls at night, but then I'd head upstairs to hang out the window and smoke pot and talk on the phone with my new stone friends, then draw THC-induced comics featuring bold mice who were themselves upstairs smoking pot and drawing comics. He found one of these comics once in my coat pocket and declared it brilliant. Can I see more? She said, and I said, and I still don't know why, that no, she couldn't see more. That was some kind of final straw. You hate me, she said, and burst into tears. You hate me, and I don't blame you. I'm a waste of a human. I don't even know why I thought I could be a good mother. I have a screw loose. All the lights are on, but there's nobody home. You should go to Alaska and live with your father. Then she went upstairs to her room. I didn't even go after her or call. Sorry. I was a stone-cold evil teen and thought the line about my father was laughable. I had no idea who the man was. And of course, after that, nothing was ever the same. It was like you'd feel if you were married to someone and then got divorced, but still had to live with each other and be polite. I guess no love is foolproof against cruelty and cold-heartedness. It can crumble, and yes, you can try to rebuild, but you never end up with what you had before you destroyed it. Then she was driving me to college. I wasn't Stanley anymore, just one of those kids who dressed in black and wore a wool hat even when it was hot. I don't know why I did that. I do know that I didn't really want to go to college, even as I wanted it more than anything in the world. The feeling in the car was hard to bear because I think we were both in shock. Where did the time go? My heart raced and I fooled with the radio. Then she told me about a dream she had a few years back. She drove down the highway and told me the dream like she was still inside of it. In the dream, she made us matching blue gowns to go to my senior prom. I stared ahead at the highway, seeing the gowns in my mind. So then I told you we could go to the prom together and I matched in our matching dresses, she said, and that's when I knew I was crazy. She laughed. And then you set the dresses on fire, and I finally got the message. And I'm sorry for how I was all those years. I just never loved anyone the way I loved you. The past tense hurt. I wanted to say, you mean how you loved me, but I didn't. What a dream, she said. Only a very thick-headed person would need a dream like that. You're not thick-headed, Ma, I said, watching the cars fly past us, but maybe get in the right lane. We got to the University of Delaware. In-state tuition was cheap, $1,000 for the semester, and I had a partial scholarship. She didn't help me pay off the rest. My dorm was old and brick and looked like what I thought college should look like. We both got out of the car and she asked me if I needed help with my suitcase and backpack and I said no thanks. She gave me a quick hug, then got back in the car and started it up while I stood there. She turned to look at me and gave a quick wave. As I watched her drive away, it finally hit me that tomorrow I'd be waking up in a building with a stranger across the room and she'd be waking up in our old house alone. How could this be? I was her life. I wished I could run after the car, but I stood stone still. She would write me letters in her small upright penmanship with the hopeful loops, telling me tidbits about her boss or Gail Tryon or a bunny she saw run through the backyard. I found those letters in a box hidden in the same closet where all our old dresses were stored. I picked out the lighthouse dress to give to Neely's funeral home for her to wear in her coffin. I tried to squeeze into the matching dress I wore when I was 13, but of course, no matter how hard I tried, it just wouldn't fit. Thank you.
Wow. Looking forward to that book too. Yes.
Our final reader of the evening is Sarah Shotland, who's the author of the novelette Junkette and the nonfiction project Abolition is Everything. She co-founded Words Without Walls, which brought creative writing classes to jails, prisons, and drug treatment centers in Pittsburgh for 13 years. Her writing about art and prison have appeared in the Iowa Review, Creative Nonfiction, Baltimore Review, and elsewhere, in 2022. She joined the faculty of Carlo University as the program director of the Mad Women in the Attic. Please welcome Sarah Shotland.
Thanks, everybody. These are such great meetings to follow, and thanks for being here tonight. I have recently discovered that I'm very sensitive to anniversaries, and we're coming up on the anniversary of the Dobbs decision, and so I've been pulling out things that I've been working on around abortion, and I'm going to read the first part of a very long essay about that, and it's called How to Survive a Name. It's 2015. I'm idling in a prison parking lot, waiting on a phone call from Planned Parenthood, radio on scan, trying to land a song I can sing along to. The creative writing class I teach each week at the prison begins at 6 p.m. I try to be ready at the metal detectors by 5:15 in case anything goes wrong. There are always things that go wrong. The state of Pennsylvania requires women to go through two screenings in order to receive a medical abortion. My first screening call is at 5 p.m. The nurse explained last week that the call will take 40 minutes, which will theoretically allow me enough time to pass through security and still make it to class on time, as long as this phone call, this circumstance in the parking lot, is the wrong thing tonight. I put my phone on speaker and listen as a doctor reads a script detailing the number of state benefits I will qualify for if I decide to carry the pregnancy to term, which of course means if I decide to have a baby, if I become a mother. It's difficult to concentrate on the long monologue the doctor delivers with rote obligation. Surely she doesn't want to be delivering this monologue. There are three other women also pregnant on the call. At various times, the doctor pauses, and we're all required to give verbal acknowledgement and consent about various statutes and risk factors. We are a trio. I understand. I understand. I understand. I was born in 1981, and my name is Sarah. Sarah was the most popular name of 1980, 81, 82, 83, 84, slipped to number two behind Jessica in 85, but we came back strong in 86, and the rest of the 80s and 90s continued in that manner. Having the most popular name of the generation is an exercise in solidarity. I'm always a plural. Invite the Sarahs. Which one of the Sarahs is on the phone? Is she a member of the Sarah Club? In a graduating high school class of 200 kids, there were 12 Sarahs. My best friend's name is Sarah. My college roommate's name was Sarah. There's a very sweet two-year-old in my life who calls me by my full name, Sarah Shotland, because so many of her mother's friends and aunties are named Sarah. At last count, I had 16 Sarahs saved in my phone. When women named Sarah meet each other, we simply nod our heads. I imagine all the other women on this phone call are also named Sarah, that were Callie heads springing from a shared body politic. In the parking lot of the prison, I'm wondering, are these other phone Sarahs in their kitchens preparing dinner or after school snacks for their other born children? Are they in the break room at their retail jobs, empty hotel conference rooms, locked in a bathroom with the shower running, trying to hide? I wonder where they live. This is one of the only clinics to get an abortion in the county, so they might be 2 blocks away or 2 hours away. I'm 33 years old, and this is my second abortion. 14 years ago, at 19, I had the first one. I was a sophomore in college with a terrible on-again, off-again boyfriend, a super fun cocaine problem, and a part-time waitressing gig at a fish place where customers were encouraged to throw their peanut shells on the ground. Every night, I would come home covered in peanut shell dust, the smell of which never seemed to wash out of my hair. That abortion seemed obvious, if not easy. It was clear that having a child would be outlandish, reckless. After that abortion, I bought an 8-ball and a bottle of wine and hung out with my girlfriends all night long, blowing rails and gulping cheap Pinot Noir. The next day, I showed up for a shift at the fish shop. By 20, I was using heroin, and at 24, I was checking into a detox center to start the slow process of recovery. But all that was over a decade ago. And here I am in a parking lot, a stone-cold sober school teacher with a boring Toyota Corolla and a bronze-level Obamacare health plan. I'm not a 19-year-old strung-out fish shack wench. If I wanted to have a baby, I could make it work, mostly because of the rock-solid group of women in my life. Every external and circumstantial detail of this parking lot is different, and yet here I am making the same second choice. What about the other Sarahs? What fish shacks do they waitress in? What bridges are they building and burning? We're giving up our rights to WIC and Medicaid, they tell us. We are answering a chorus in the affirmative. After each statement, the doctor on the speakerphone declares, "We understand. We understand. We understand." Slowly, we become a chorus. Disenfranchised grief is the therapeutic term for mourning an unacknowledged loss. Maybe it's the death of a mistress, having an estranged parent, the IVF treatment that never works, the adoption that never comes through. Disenfranchised grief could refer to a bankruptcy or gradual hearing loss or retirement from a job you spent 40 years complaining about. Disenfranchised grief also involves stigma and acknowledgement. Children, for example, are generally left out of our communal rites of grief. And so when they experience loss, it often becomes disenfranchised because they have to stay quiet. When someone shoots themselves in the head or drinks themselves into a drowned liver or is sentenced to death by the state, that's all stigmatized, disenfranchised grief. Abortions, too, are a disenfranchised grief. The loss of a decade to heroin, that's a disenfranchised grief. The 15 years I spent working in prisons, each day witnessing the loss of possibility and personhood, the potential that just radiates out of prison, that was all me swimming in disembodied, disenfranchised grief. And one of the challenges therapists grapple with when working with clients who are experiencing this disenfranchised grief is the struggle to explain the meaningfulness of a relationship without having a name that encapsulates its importance. When people deal with grief, they deal not only with loss, but with language. We want a way to name the pain and be acknowledged. We want a way for our love to be recognized. I want to tell the men in my class what's happening in this parking lot. The theme of the class this semester is masculinity, and I'm the only woman in the room. Each week, these men write about their fathers, the things they were taught and the things they should have been taught, the heavenly and earthly fathers, the ways in which they can and cannot perform their own responsibilities as parents, the ways in which culture has encouraged their self-destruction, their community destruction. And in many ways, these men have become idealized versions of the masculinity that teaches us to conquer, destroy, fight, earn. This is why they're here. They've excelled. They are the overachievers in the subject of masculinity. They write about their failures as fathers, and I want to tell them, I'm a failure at even becoming a mother. I'm usually at the metal detector by now. I'm usually being searched and waiting for my administrative escort to ferry me across the prison yard. I definitely don't want to tell my students at the university that I'm having a second abortion in my 30s. I have no desire at all to tell a coworker or a member of my writing group this. I'm obviously not going to bring this up with the 14-year-old middle school students I'm teaching about the Harlem Renaissance this week. In every other place in my life, the boundaries seem so clear and defined. They might even be called healthy. But at the prison, I want to be known and seen, vulnerable. I want some kind of unhealthy approval from these men. I want them to let me face them. Do I want to tell them I'm having an abortion because somewhere deep inside, I believe it's a crime? Do I want to tell them about this because they're the people in my life who most understand impossible choices? That they have all the wisdom when it comes to choosing between options that are all undesirable, harmful, wrong? They're the people in my life who know the most about consequences and the ways those consequences come to rest in the base of your neck, how to spit them out, how to metabolize or metastasize them, how to keep it moving. Do I want to tell them about my abortion because I want their advice on how to survive my own violence? Of course, I'm not going to tell them in my class about what's happening in the parking lot. They're not meant to comfort or care for me. And after all, they don't tell me about what happens in their cells. Instead, we meet in the middle space between the parking lot and the cell blocks in the classrooms, where we show each other the weight of our choices in 1,000 different homes. We explain to each other without saying it plain what the choices really were, what the consequences really are. Instead of telling the group of men about what's happening in the parking lot, I'll just hang up the phone with the other Sarahs. I'll move quickly into a new name, Professor Shotland. Before I button her up and put Professor Shotland on, for a quick slip of a second, I feel the slide into a different Sarah, a third, a fourth Sarah. She's 7. She's on the side of the Dallas freeway, standing by a sign as tall as her small body that reads, "Abortion stops a beating heart." Her father, my father, beaming beside her as the trucks honk. She's there in a flash, then gone, Professor Shotland shooing her away, clearing her throat. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. I want to just let you know that in 2 weeks, on Tuesday, June the 13th, the readers will be back to poetry. The readers will be Paula Corso, Tuhin Das, Shaheen Dill, and Barbara Edelman. And I would like, and now that is just 2 weeks away, I'd like for all of you to know that this reading tonight is being recorded, and it will be fairly soon on the Hemingway's Poetry Series blogspot, so that you can hear it again. And I think there's a lot here you might want to hear again. Okay. And there are also about 11 years of poetry and some prose on that blog spot that you can have a chance to hear Ed Oldchester, Judy Vollmer, Terrence Haynes, all sorts of people have read in this series, and so many amazing, amazing local poets here. So, and some prose writers. I'm going to read now something from Ginny Savelli, the founder of our series. Here's Ginny. Here is, and I think it actually is interesting because this particular poem has a good deal to do with masculinity, a kind of desperation, and grief. First pride, then the fall. I don't know what makes a man fall from grace. Usually the fall is unseen by the fallen. They usually hit the ground hard. and spend the remainder of their lives trying to get up. I don't know why I'm thinking of Jacob's ladder, a climb from earth to heaven. I'm drinking a cup of strong coffee and thinking of my friend who was a chief of police, a good man, honorable to a fault, church-loving man, loves God, feared the flames of hell because I spoke with him and knew of his fears and love and saw in his eyes an emptiness, almost like he had no more tears to shed. For I'm sure, as there is treachery, he often cried alone, as if he were in a garden awaiting betrayal. I think sometimes men fall from a ladder because the ladder is too high. And in the fear of height, they lose their footing. Sometimes the rung of the ladder is slick and their foot slips. Sometimes the rung of the ladder breaks and they fall. Sometimes men are trying to get past them and they climb up your back, step on your neck, smash your fingers, and it's hard to hold on to the ladder with crushed fingers. Sometimes you are tossed down by the gods, all in the name of hubris. It has been said often by greater men, first pride, then the fall. I have fallen often. Sometimes because of a slip, and often, too often, I have been pushed or tossed. It matters not the fall as much, the tumult and awful sound. I sounded like a big bag of shit, thumping down, hitting hard on the ground. And then the question, how high the bounce? That can only be measured by the height of the climb, equally proportionate to the fall, almost like measuring action to reaction. But a bag of shit almost always makes the sound of an awful flood. Now, what makes a fall so hard is when others are tossed down with you, and often those tossed down land on you, kind of like you become their pillow, which of course softens their fall. Sometimes I drink strong coffee just to say, stay awake so that I don't dream of ladders like Jacob. Guess maybe I just want my feet on the ground, and I'm just tired of helping up good, honorable men. I'm just tired of seeing the empty eyes of men praying in gardens with crushed fingers. Thank you.
Now, you may have come to your attention that we are in a bookstore. That means you have an opportunity to buy books, including those of Damien Bresic, and they are here, and also copies of Sarah Shotland's book, Junket, and a whole bunch of others that are real good. So I would encourage you. And that what? And that, oh, and that I think they will sign them. Yes. What could be better? So we have we ought to get started on that. I think we have till about 8:20 or 8:30 maybe for you to buy some books. And then we sort of have to clear out of here. And the poets, if you would be kind enough to join us for a photograph, and thank you all. Thank you, Chris. Thank you. Thank you, Ari. You did a great job.
Woo-hoo. Yeah. Thank you. And thank you, Art Well. Thank you.